This is Hacker Daily for Friday, May 11th, and today we're talking about Google's new voice AI making restaurant reservations for you, why you shouldn't use ad blockers, a meta conversation about Hacker Daily itself, and subscription hell. I'm Dave Zorub.
And I'm Harish Agarwal.
Thanks for tuning in to Hacker Daily, featuring top stories for hackers, founders, and makers. Please remember to subscribe and rate us on your podcast app.
Good evening.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi, I'd like to reserve a table for Friday the 3rd.
Okay, hold on one moment.
Mm-hmm.
That humming male voice on that clip is Google's new AI assistant called Duplex. The company says that the technology is directed towards completing specific tasks like scheduling certain types of appointments. And for these tasks, the system makes the conversational experience as natural as possible, allowing people to speak normally like they would to another person without having to adapt to a machine. One of their key research insights was to constrain Duplex to what they call closed domains, which are narrow enough to explore extensively. Let's listen to one more example before we discuss this.
How can I help you?
Hello?
Hello, what's up, man?
Hey, I wanted to know what are your hours for today?
10 a.m. to 6:30 p.m.
Okay, got it. Thank you for your time.
No problem, sir. Bye.
All right, we can definitely take one thing away from this. The Google Duplex male voice is a pretty chill bro. But other than that, my first reaction was, wow, this is like pretty awesome. I'm a programmer and an engineer like a lot of you, and so I'm pretty conflict avoidant and maybe even human interaction avoidant. So I'm the kind of person who puts off phone calls as much as possible. And it seems like a lot of folks in tech are the same way. If you look at a lot of the recent on-demand apps, one of the whole value propositions for them is that they remove this human element from a lot of different kinds of transactions, like getting a taxi, or buying some groceries, or anything like that. So from the perspective of an on-demand consumer, this seems like a pretty big win. But then, you know, things get a little weirder the more you think about them. Google's invested what I'm sure is millions of dollars and the hours and hours of very bright minds into creating this really imperfect human voice that ahs and ums, just like I do, honestly, when I'm hosting this show. What does that mean for the person on the other end? Do they know that they're interacting with a computer? Would it matter if they knew that they were interacting with a computer? I'm guessing that the ahs and ums are there so that the person on the other side doesn't feel like they're talking to a robot. But do they have a right to know that they're talking to a robot? Commenter Cromwellian wrote on Hacker News, "The people losing their marbles over this being some kind of Turing test passing dystopian stuff are missing the point of how limited this domain is. People who answer phones to take bookings perform an extremely limited set of questions and responses. That's why they can even be replaced by dumb voice response systems in many cases. In these cases, the human being answering the phone is themselves acting like a bot, following a repetitive script. Duplex seems trained against this corpus. The end game would be for the business to run something like Duplex on the other side, and then you'd have Duplex talking to Duplex. Most people working in hair salons or restaurants are very busy with customers and don't want to handle these calls, so I think the reverse of this Duplex system, a more natural voice booking system for small businesses, would help them free up their workers to focus on customers." Benedict Evans, one of the partners at Andreessen Horowitz, gave some historical perspective on this on Twitter. He wrote, "In the early days of elevators, it was not clear whether it was part of the staircase and corridors or another room. Was it public space or private space? Do you sit down?" Back in 1918, we might have asked, is it rude to sit down or keep my hat on when using a telephone? Whereas now, in 2018, we might ask, is it rude for a computer to telephone a restaurant and pretend to be a person? The lesson of Microsoft Office macroviruses was to ask, what could an asshole do with this API? The lesson from Cambridge Analytica was exactly the same. Now, apply to machine learning, voice, and computer vision. What can an asshole do with those APIs? Coming soon, CAPTCHAs for phone calls.
Samuel Ricks, a freelance technical writer, wrote a blog asking internet users to please stop using Adblock, but not for the reasons you may think. Ricks is referring to ad-blocking software which filters ads from web content. A common argument for limiting the use of ad-block technology is it can hurt all publishers of content, big or small, in unintended ways. Ricks, however, explores what he calls a darker side of ad-blocking, diving into the mechanics of Adblock Plus, a popular ad-blocking tool. Adblock Plus launched a program called Acceptable Ads in 2011. Acceptable ads was meant to encourage publishers to use so-called non-intrusive ads. No animations, no sounds, or flashy colors. It was, on the face of it, an attempt to address some of the problems with ad-blocking technology by allowing non-intrusive advertising to continue to fund publishers' work. The catch, Rick says, is that in order to qualify for Adblock Plus's Acceptable Ads program, you have to pay. They charge roughly 30% of ad revenue for the privilege of being whitelisted as an acceptable ad. In essence, acceptable ads is adding a tax on ad companies, standing between them and consumers of ads, without many of their users even being aware of it. Rick's conclusion is not that all ad blocking technology is flawed, but that the particular incentives of acceptable ads create an inherently untrustworthy tool. His recommendation is to find other tools like uBlock Origin which do not have the same flaws.
All right, so this week on Hacker Daily, we're going to try something new, and that's actually talking to each other, which we haven't done before on the show.
We don't really do it in real life either.
That's kind of by design, mostly because we don't actually have space to be in the same room or to even have like a quiet place to record together. So even today, for example, I'm like in my bedroom at home while my daughter is out on the playground with supervision. Preesh, where are you?
I am in my living room, which is adjacent to two construction sites, which I can't predict when they're going to be active. It's a lot of fun.
So this is basically just an advertisement for living in New York City. But I think the bigger thing is that, like, you know, we were kind of surprised that this podcast actually works in the first place, right? Like, yeah. This whole thing, we started like a little over a month ago as an idea. And the concept was basically like, okay, can we create something that people might actually want here? Like, there's a lot of podcasts out in the world. There isn't a daily podcast that's focused on tech news or programmer news or hacker news. And so we thought, okay, what would happen if we just kind of tried it out? And I think it's worked better than either of us expected. And we wrote a blog post about it, which you can read. So we're not going to like summarize that. But it really is surprising. And that's sort of why we're not even prepared to do this in any kind of like professional context.
Yeah, we're really learning as we go along. You know, this is the first conversation we're doing for a reason. Yesterday we spent a lot of time agonizing about how to even record the conversation. We really don't know what we're doing. I think, you know, on Dave's note that it was surprising that it worked. What's interesting about it is that people seem to still have a lot of demand for tech content. That's interesting to me because I've always viewed podcasts as a very techy kind of thing. So you would think that there would be a ton of you know, just amazing, great tech news content out there. And there's a lot of good stuff out there, but it still seems underrepresented. The kind of stories that we're talking about, which are sourced mostly from Hacker News and some other places, I don't necessarily think that other podcasts are covering them. And that in and of itself is surprising.
Right. The fact that we could, as amateur podcasters, get an audience at all, like pretty quickly, and serve a need that hadn't been served yet. Like on the web, it seems like every possible angle on tech is already covered. I know that's not entirely true, but it seems like there's like a limitless supply of commentary and news, right? And I guess that's part of the function of Hacker News is to filter that supply anyway.
Yeah. Well, one way that you frame it, Dave, which I find to be pretty compelling, is podcasting still feels like the App Store in the early days, the iPhone App Store in the early days. where, you know, it's kind of the Wild Wild West, and you can build some interesting experiments and get a lot of distribution, you know, really feel out demand without having to worry about professional production quality, which is really exciting. It's cool to be able to experiment like that.
Yeah, for sure. And I've gotten like totally obsessed with podcasts and podcasting since we've been involved in this. I was talking to a friend the other day, and he was saying that there's like something special about podcasts in particular, where there's a demand for something that like a small number of people are super interested in, and a host or hosts that actually know what they're talking about, versus like, not that we necessarily know that much about what we're talking about, but you know, we're programmers and founders and entrepreneurs, and we're not like media types just reading off a script that somebody else wrote for us. We're actually kind of bringing some of our own experience as programmers and entrepreneurs into covering some of these stories, right? And that's as opposed to like a kind of mainstream podcast that's trying to shoot for, you know, millions of listeners every day, or a radio show or something, where the content by definition kind of has to be a little bit more generalized, and not as specific to a a certain community, or using technical terms or whatever it is.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what's interesting about this, you know, you're talking a little bit about how we're bringing our own point of view into it. In the beginning, I think we were specifically trying to not do that.
We were
really just summarizing news stories. It was a little bit mechanical. And we sent out a survey to our listeners early on and asked what was working and what wasn't. Overwhelmingly, the response was that we needed to be doing more commentary. We needed to be injecting more of ourselves into it. And, you know, at least for me, you know, Dave kind of mentioned it, some of the hesitation was, well, who am I to be doing this commentary? You know, I've been in this world for a while and been reading Hacker News for a long time, but I'm certainly no expert on the material.
For sure.
But what's been cool about it is it's actually more fun to add that commentary. And at least podcasting is a strange world. You don't always know what's working and what isn't. But at least from the little feedback that we have gotten, it seems that those are the pieces where we do go deep and we do some of our own commentary. That's what people want. That's what people like. And we've been trying to do more of that as a result.
Yeah, for sure. And it's definitely been an interesting journey, because we were trying to just keep it fairly objective, kind of simple summaries of what shows up on Hacker News. But, and I get it, people want something a little bit more than that. People kind of want to know who we are and what our take is, you know, what we're bringing to the table here. And also, I think the medium has, and when I say the medium, I mean podcasting, has a kind of expectation that you have these hosts who are talking to each other, and you kind of want to know, you know, who they are and what their relationship is and stuff. So we're kind of trying to figure that out. You know, the truth is that it's actually been a lot of work, right?
Yeah. You know, there's a lot about this that we've been learning as we go, which has been a lot of fun. You know, in terms of the prep that we've been doing, we would prep scripts every night. And we would, you know, try and be careful about the stories that we're selecting. We didn't want to cover things that you were going to read about anyway in the Post or, you know, New York Times or wherever. So we were being really careful about the stories we were covering, actually recording. And, you know, this is from a perspective of somebody who has really never recorded his voice professionally or in any context before. Recording is a lot of work. You end up doing many takes of, you know, the same segment over and over again, because you need to get it right. The mistakes that you make when you're doing takes, which, you know, like those mistakes may not seem that big when you're doing them or when you're making them, but when you listen to it later, they're huge. They get amplified in recording. So you really have to get it, you know, not perfect, but you have to get it right. The other thing that's been a huge surprise to me is editing breaths. Apparently, I am a heavy breather, which I didn't know. And I'm sorry to everybody who had prior knowledge of this, you know, and I just
not
wasn't
too many
aware
people.
Of it. Yeah. Well, now the whole world knows, or at least the few people who are listening to this. You know, you don't want to be, I'm assuming as a podcast listener, you don't want to be hearing me breathe. So in post-processing, we'll go and we'll edit out all the breaths. And I think it's a little bit more severe for my tracks. So, you know, that ends up taking time. And then, you know, Dave is actually the one who in my view, makes a lot of this possible. I don't know, Dave, like how much time do you spend actually putting together the tracks at the end of the day?
Yes, so I'm drawing on kind of previous experience working with music. So I used to play in bands and record music, and I ran a weird record label in San Francisco, I don't know, 15 years ago. And so I'm drawing on that experience. It's very different doing voice, and also the cadence of doing it every day makes it like a lot higher pressure. So by the end of our kind of 3-week initial run here, it didn't take me that long to stitch everything together. But still, as Harish was saying, just like trying to get the initial quality of the takes to be high enough is actually the hardest thing. And that actually, there's a parallel to music there. It's like there's you know, people always say it's like, well, you can record it and they're like, oh, we'll fix it later. You messed up a note, we'll like go fix it later. It's like actually just a lot easier just to make it sound really good the first time than it is to try to use some kind of magic to improve the sound quality later, to try to like fix a mistake, right? So ultimately, and we're gonna hopefully get better at this over time too, like just having a great recording setup, you know, that's quiet, that's conducive to the kind of sound that we want to create, is going to be the thing that is going to make this sound better and a lot easier to make from here on out. For me, the big lesson here is that there seems to be just a place for this kind of show, a show about the kind of things that show up on Hunter News. And that actually goes back to something that Paul Graham, the founder of Y Combinator, I mean, most of the people listening here probably know who Paul Graham is, who wrote in one of his essays about how to choose a startup idea. He said, you can either build something a large number of people want a small amount, or something a small number of people want a large amount. And you should choose the latter. So this is hopefully something a small number of people really want. And that's what we're going to try to do going forward, not to try to shoot to build a huge audience or to shoot for kind of like middle of the road tech news or any kind of news, but rather kind of doubling down on the kinds of things that, you know, we as founders and programmers and engineers would want to hear.
So, yeah, I mean, with that in mind, enough about us. We wanted to talk about one of the most trending stories on Hacker News this week. It's a story about subscription hell, which I think, you know, one thing that's happened as we've been doing this over the last few weeks, you get an appreciation for clickbait titles and, you know, how much art or time must go into them. I think subscription hell is an amazing clickbait title. I immediately wanted to know what the article was about. I immediately had some preconceived notions about what the article was about. And, you know, I'm guessing so did a lot of you who read it. If you haven't read it, it's an article by Danny Crichton on TechCrunch. And you might already be able to guess what it's about. Danny Crichton is writing about this phenomena. It's a modern phenomena, seemingly, of every single content source, every product, every software as a service play adopting a paid subscription model to generate revenue. So, you know, I think about this, I think about my own personal list, and it immediately makes sense. You know, I pay for, and this is just the subset that I can think of off the top of my head. I pay for Netflix, Amazon Prime, HBO Now, Hulu, the New York Times, the Washington Post. And those are sort of the easy mainstream ones. I also pay for Stratechery, which is an amazing newsletter that has a paid subscription model. I also pay for one called Hot Pod. This is a recent one, I promise. Hot Pod is safe for work. It's a newsletter for podcasting.
It's really good. It's like the Stratechery of podcasting.
It's amazing. And if you have any interest in podcasting at all, from sort of the more nuts and bolts kind of point of view, you should check it out. There is a free version of it. I ended up subscribing because I want to support it and I want to get the premium content. And then, you know, there's also just a handful of other stuff, from charitable contributions to other products that I use, which have this model.
Yeah, and you're forgetting stuff like GitHub. I pay for Photoshop. I pay for, you know, your cell phone bill. You pay for cable, power, and basically everything you can think of, plus like probably dozens of pieces of software that I can't think of, right? That if you add it all up, it's actually a ton of money.
Yeah, it's a ton of money. You know, it's a ton of work. It's a ton of time. It sounds trivial, maybe, or it sounds, trite complaining, but you do have to sign up for every single one of these services. There's a lot of mental energy spent in keeping track of everything that you're subscribed to. I don't even think I know what that list is anymore. I'm sure I have outstanding subscriptions. My favorite one from, 10 years ago that I just realized I'm still subscribed to is Boingo, the hotspot subscription.
Ooh, that's a good one.
Yeah, it's still taxing me for $6 a month and I haven't used it for years.
Wow.
There's probably other stuff like that floating around. There's just a lot of energy spent in keeping track of and paying for all of these different subscriptions, which is why, subscription hell, it rings true. And I'd be surprised if it didn't ring true for a lot of people in this situation. Now, what I think is sort of the elephant in the room here, particularly with the recent news cycle about privacy violations. The interesting thing here is that there's sort of a yin and yang between subscription models and advertising models. There's usually a trade-off being made where, if you want to access our content, our service for free, sure, you can do that, but we're probably going to be in some way packaging up your data, your information, and selling it to advertisers so they can target you and we can make money via those advertisements, via that targeting mechanism. That trade-off leads to this kind of dichotomy where there are big, big products like Google or Facebook who are driving that advertising model forward. And then there are a host of other, some big, some smaller products that are really making a go of it with this subscription model. So, I think the one thing that, in my opinion, is kind of missing from this discussion, or we're at least like, I didn't see it in the article on TechCrunch, is not everyone has this option of advertising. And I think that's why the subscription model is starting to become a little bit more prevalent for some of these super niche vertical products that you're seeing emerge. Dave and I, for example, recently started a software as a service business. It had this subscription model baked in, and it's exactly the kind of product where we wouldn't expect there to be a lot of page views being generated. There aren't going to be a lot of people who are viewing any of the content of our product. They would be using the service. So that dichotomy isn't even there in that example. We're kind of backed into, you pay for the software, the service, or we don't make any money.
Right.
So, where does that leave us? Crichton kind of hones in on this model of maybe instead of having all of these individual subscriptions that you're paying for, you should, here's the word that I think is going to trigger a lot of discussion. You should potentially bundle a lot of those subscriptions up into something that's a little bit more value add, less mental overhead. The example that he cites is apparently, I didn't know this until I read the article, apparently Hulu, Scribd, and Spotify are investigating a deal. They haven't struck a deal yet, but they're investigating a deal which would bundle their services together in a subscription that gives you access to all three services.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think on the latest Spotify earnings thing, they may already be doing a pilot with Hulu or something where there's they're looking at other people to partner with that'll drive like additional subscriptions.
Yeah, and I'm sure it will, right? Like it seems that that's the whole value of bundling. And what's ironic about it is, a lot of the phenomenon of what we're seeing right now is the effect of unbundling. Right. So like Netflix is sort of the poster boy for this, where instead of paying for a bundle of channels from your cable provider, you can now kind of pick and choose what you want from all of these different subscription services, one of which is Netflix. They started out just aggregating a lot of content from different producers, and now they're producing their own content.
And then you also have Amazon Prime, right, which has a lot of original video content, plus like movies and stuff you'll see elsewhere. You got HBO Now, which I think we just actually canceled our HBO Now subscription because
right.
We're in a little bit of our own subscription hell here
yeah.
at the Kalfas Zorab household. at some point, it's like, okay, well, we all ditched cable, right? Because we were like, oh, we would just want everything on the internet. But now you add up all the subscriptions on the internet that we have for Prime, Netflix, HBO, Hulu. And there's like, we have the extra additional Hulu thing that gets rid of ads because like we were watching a lot of Top Chef for a while. And I think we're still paying for that. Everything, when you start adding it up, it ends up being way more expensive than cable ever was.
Totally. But I mean, I think it's worth pointing out that when it was first happening, people loved it. People still love it.
Yeah.
Right. And I think it's because when you have this unbundling, you just get way more choice than you used to have. Right. And you know, that's a very sort of closely held belief that giving consumers a lot of choice is exactly what you should be doing, right? That's better for everybody. Now, I mean, you know, it seems like it's hard to track that without tracking this phenomenon of subscription hell, where, you know, now we have that choice, but like you said, there's just too much stuff to keep track of, too many payments to be made, and it feels like you're not getting value anymore.
And I think that especially, it's one thing to think about that as a consumer, but if you think about it as a company, there's a whole other layer here where services like Slack and Dropbox and others like basically encourage individuals or small teams within larger organizations to sign up, you know, with their company credit cards. Right. And so then you have like however many different subscriptions to the same product kind of seeding within an organization. And it's unclear whether or not there's cost savings that could be happening or like if there's wasteful usage or who the contact person is for the entire account. So you get into this whole other layer. Like it's complicated enough as like an individual consumer or as a family, like, okay, this is my Apple Music subscription and we have some App Store subscriptions and all this other stuff. But if you also have like, let's say 50 to 100 or 1,000 people buying subscriptions for the same company, things get really crazy. It's a different circle of subscription hell, if you will.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we just started our company Outrank in October, and I can count at least 10 different you know, sort of like corporate facing subscriptions that we have. And we don't, you know, we're pretty cost conscious. We're not signing up for everything. But I already can't keep track of everything that we pay for and use on a monthly basis. So, you know, all of this to me, it brings to mind this quote, which I had to look this up. This quote is attributed to Jim Barksdale. For those of you who don't know, Jim Barksdale is Netscape's former CEO. He and Mark Andreessen, who you might have more familiarity with, you know, just given the times. Of course, Mark Andreessen at this point is a very well-known venture capitalist, but had a string of, you know, billion-dollar companies before that. Jim Barksdale is credited with a quote which says, "There's only two ways I know of to make money, bundling and unbundling." Now, you know, the mythology behind this quote is that Barksdale wasn't thinking too hard about the quote. He was actually on his way to the airport and, you know, was asked a question and he was trying to figure out how to get out of that conversation. And he kind of made this off the cuff remark. You know, it's been repeated over and over again. It made a Harvard Business Review article at some point recently. It's become, you know, sort of a well-known mantra in the tech world. And it seems like that's ultimately what this subscription hell article is about. We're in subscription hell because of unbundling, which made sense at the time. It was really good for consumers. But now we want to go back to a world where there's more efficiencies and we're willing to make some of these trade-offs. You know, with the Hulu, Scribd, and Spotify deal, we would obviously be getting a better value for those three services. And from the point of view of Hulu, Scribd, and Spotify, they'd probably be getting access to a larger subscriber base, but we'd be going back to this world of bundling. It would just look different than the cable bundles that we had before. You know, Hulu, Scribd, and Spotify is very different from any sort of bundle that I can imagine from any point in time before. But we're going to be introducing all of these other potential problems. You know, from my point of view, I don't think I ever use Scribd, and I don't know what its premium features are. So if I opt into this bundle, maybe I would opt into it because I want Hulu and Spotify. All of a sudden, I'm going to be paying for Scribd, which I might not use, which sounds a lot like when I would pay for a cable bundle and never watch ESPN.
Yeah, neither of us would ever watch ESPN, but we're, you know, paying whatever, a dollar plus a month for it, which is what I think the Comcast and other cable companies pay them.
Totally. And I mean, it seems like this is just proving out that quote. And it seems like, you know, we're just in this endless cycle of unbundling and bundling and unbundling, and there's going to be value created at every point. And the decisions that are being made are probably going to make sense at every point. But we're never going to reach some sort of stasis where everyone is happy with the existing situation.
I mean, on the software side, one of the more interesting things that I saw recently was something called SetApp, which is a subscription to Mac desktop software, which I think it's like $15 a month now, and you get like 80 pieces of software that would normally cost, usually you probably pay, you know, $15-$20 for each of them individually. But now you're just doing a subscription, you get a little folder on your Mac, and all of a sudden you have all these utilities. And it seems like from the outside pretty cool, like, okay, there's all these things for programming, for keyboard shortcuts, text editing, image editing, etc. If you read Hacker News or work in the tech world, a lot of this stuff would probably be useful. But then you think, okay, well, $15 a month doesn't sound that much, but it's actually a fair amount of money spread over the course of the year. How much would it actually cost to buy the things that you actually use out of this setup bundle, right?
Right.
So you're back in the same, it's the same thing. The pendulum swings one way, it swings the other way.
Yeah, such is life.
That's all for Hacker Daily this week. Thanks so much for tuning in, for giving us a shot in this new format. We'd love to hear your feedback. Please reach out to us via email at info@hackerdaily.co, or you can follow us on Twitter or DM us. Our handle is Hacker Daily. And we'll be back next week with more stories for hackers, founders, and makers. Thanks so much for listening, and have a great weekend.